nuclear weapons, and uranium enrichment. With the recent U.S. bombings of three of Iran's nuclear facilities dealing with nuclear enrichment, the questions remain. How close was that country to being able to build a nuclear weapon? How effective was the U.S. in stopping their progress? And the bottom line is, how hot does uranium have to get in order to be useful in a weapon? The answer may surprise you, because I asked that question of a genuine expert, a PhD physicist, mathematician, and nuclear consultant. And when he tells us,
enrichment is simply the process of slowly and patiently increasing the percentage of the chain reacting variety of uranium. And when it gets up to 90% of that chain reacting type, then it's called weapons grade uranium. So many people make the mistake of thinking that just because it's called weapons grade uranium, that's what you need to make a weapon. 90% is what you need. Not true. You can make a weapon with much lower degrees of enrichment.
How low can it go? I was shocked, I tell you, to learn exactly how low that enrichment needs to be in order to create a nuclear weapon. So when Dr. Gordon Edwards, co-founder and head of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility, clearly and concisely lays out the facts of enrichment so that we can understand what's happening in Iran and what the media has gotten wrong in reporting the story, you take a deep breath and face the now ramped up awfulness we face from that terrible, awful, deadly, dangerous seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are leaking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. We're a show for people who know nothing about nuclear who want to know something, and people who know something about nuclear who would like to know just a little bit more. My name is Libby Halevi. I am the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, a cornerstone interview that decodes the issues behind the recent U.S. bombing of Iran's nuclear facilities. We talk about what uranium enrichment consists of and how almost every journalist covering this issue has been getting it wrong about Iran's current nuclear weapons capability. I talk with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility on what it takes uranium-wise to build a weapon and why the recent U.S. bombings did nothing significant except enrage an almost nuclear-capable country and its allies along with sane people around the world. It is a total eye-opener. We will also have nuclear news from around the world, Numbnuts of the Week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, Jack Cohen Joppa of the Nuke Resistor with another story from our shared history of successful activist resistance, all of it coming up in just a few moments. Today is Tuesday, July 1st, 2025, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. Following up on last week's coverage of the United States bombing of nuclear sites in Iran, the International Atomic Energy Agency has identified additional impact points at the Fordo and Natanz nuclear sites in Iran, including possible localized contamination and chemical hazards. A statement issued by the IAEA says, quote, regarding the additional strikes to Fordo that were reported early on Monday, after the U.S. bombing of the facility early on Sunday, these were the strikes by Israel, The IAEA assesses that access roads close to the underground facility and one of its entrances were hit. At Nantans, the IAEA said that it has identified, quote, two impact holes from the U.S. strikes above the underground halls that have been used for enrichment as well as for storage. Based on its knowledge of what these halls contained, the IAEA assesses that this strike may have caused localized contamination and chemical hazards. And according to an extensive story in Rolling Stones at rollingstone.com, Iran still has the components needed to build a nuclear weapon, even after President Donald Trump ordered airstrikes on its nuclear sites, even as military hardliners dissatisfied with the weakness shown by their country's leadership are poised to gain greater control. Trump has insisted America's strikes on Iran's nuclear sites caused, quote, total obliteration, end quote, and has attacked the media for questioning this narrative after a leaked report from the Defense Intelligence Agency contradicted the administration's claims. And now we have comparable claims coming from the International Atomic Energy Agency. This report from Rolling Stone is many pages long and quite extensive, and we will link to it on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 731. In a lonely piece of good news coming out of what is called the Big Beautiful Bill, otherwise known as the billionaire's, fill in a blank with a word we can't say on radio, bill, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act passed in the Senate as part of the reconciliation bill, securing the largest expansion ever. The bill was championed by Senator Josh Hawley, a Republican of Missouri, who says the state is set to receive approximately $1 billion in new funding to support providers and, interestingly enough and questionable, Medicaid recipients over the next 5 years. Hawley goes on to say, I will continue to do everything in my power to reverse future cuts to Medicaid. If Republicans want to be the party of the working class, we cannot cut health insurance for working people. RECA is generational legislation for Missouri, intended to deliver some measure of justice for survivors in the St. Louis region who were exposed to legacy radioactive waste dating back to the Manhattan Project to build the world's first atomic bombs, starting in 1942. The RECA provision will deliver long overdue compensation and health care for survivors of radiation-linked cancers in the St. Louis and St. Charles areas. Lots of nuclear stories coming out as we approach the 80th anniversary of the start of the atomic age with the explosion of the first bomb, the Trinity test, on July 16, 1945. An article by William Hartung in Forbes is Why Spending More on Nuclear Weapons May Be a Bad Bet. Ya think? We'll link to the full article, and we will also link to this one on the other side of the spectrum. Trump should abolish the nuclear agency. Say what? This comes from the self-confessed conservative cityjournal.org. The subhead reads, A safer, cleaner future is within reach, but only if the president replaces the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. This article is truly numbnuts adjacent, and it too will be linked on the website NuclearHotSeat.com under this episode, number 731. And now,
Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, Nuclear Hot Seat, numbnuts of the week.
A U.S. nuclear missile base has been invaded by a predator capable of mass infrastructural damage. Squirrels. The Minot Air Force Base in North Dakota has been overrun with Richardson ground squirrels, known to personnel as DAT rats. While they may seem cute, they are capable of causing structural damage to the base, which just received an $850 million upgrade for its nuclear weapons capabilities, but nothing to handle the squirrels. Minot is home to two branches of the U.S. nuclear triad, 26 B-52 bombers capable of carrying nuclear weapons, and 150 intercontinental ballistic missiles. Could squirrels take down the U.S. nuclear triad? The difficulties in getting rid of the squirrels, besides their overwhelming numbers, is the elimination of natural predators in that part of the world, which means the squirrels can reproduce en masse, regular pesticides that don't work against them, and the inability to spray more toxic poisons around the base because that's against federal law and could harm the children of service members who live on the base. So here's another option, courtesy Nuclear Hot Seat. If you can't get rid of the squirrels, get rid of the nukes. And that's why, all you cute little squirrel commandos, you are this week's
Nuclear Hot Seat, none that's out a week.
And if you would like to see a picture of one of those four-legged combatants, go to nuclearhotseat.com, episode number 731, where, with the help of AI, we managed to get a picture of one of the culprits. Of course, it's up on the website. Over to Japan, where for those who think that nuclear is going to be a quick fix to climate change and our energy needs, know that the completion of Japan Nuclear Fuel's nuclear fuel reprocessing plant in the village of Rukasho, Aomori Prefecture, which has been postponed numerous times, could be achieved next year, or so they say. It took a public relations official at Japan Nuclear Fuel to say that the company is, quote, now confident to a certain degree, now that is a quote, that the plant for processing spent fuel from nuclear power stations will be completed in fiscal 2026. Then again, that can has been kicked down the road so many times, we have no idea how accurate his assessment is. Construction began in 1993. It was originally scheduled to be completed in 1997, and that completion has been postponed as many as 27 times. Going international now, with two stories that show exactly how dangerous nuclear power reactors can be. In a dramatic turn of events, a near catastrophe was narrowly averted at France's Golfech nuclear power plant when a technician's error went unnoticed for 18 hours, leaving the reactor without cooling for its radioactive nuclear core. A technician accidentally closed the wrong cooling valve, leading to that shutdown of the critical system. The incident, which happened on June 15, 2025, underscores the importance of constant vigilance and highlights the intricate balance required in managing nuclear operations. Human error, which is impossible to predict, is always a potential factor. And in East Lothian, Scotland, the Tornos nuclear reactor, which began operating in 1988, 37 years ago, has been discovered to have 585 cracks in the graphite core of the nuclear reactor, prompting fears of a nuclear meltdown and calling for its early closure. In documents released under Freedom of Information Law, the UK Government Safety Watchdog, the Office for Nuclear Regulation, said that the state of the graphite core posed, quote, a significant challenge to plans to keep Tornos and other aging nuclear stations running over the next 5 years. EDF Energy, the French company that operates the reactor, has already decided to ignore this problem and extend the life of Tornos from 2028 closure to 2030. Campaigners accuse EDF of putting profits before safety and warned that keeping, quote, clapped out reactors running, nice British term there, would endanger the public, and time for these aging reactors to be closed is right now. In Ukraine, Russia is unable to restore the safe operation of the occupied Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant, and its statements about such intentions are merely an attempt to blackmail Ukraine and the international community. Yuri Shchenko, first deputy energy minister of Ukraine, said, the plant is not ready to open. There are major risks involved in restarting the reactors. A full inspection of the equipment and systems is necessary, as no maintenance has been carried out at Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. There is no qualified personnel familiar with the equipment, including Ukrainian-made components installed during the plant's modernization. Meanwhile, Russia is quibbling about what to do with U.S. nuclear fuel stored at Zaporizhzhia. Rafael Grossi, head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, told Reuters that restarting it was currently impossible because of the lack of a stable power supply and water for cooling. Russia was willing to either use the fuel supplied by U.S. company Westinghouse or to remove it entirely and ship it back to the United States. Westinghouse and U.S. energy officials had previously raised intellectual property concerns with Russia in connection with the fuel issue. Not safety concerns, intellectual property. Such priorities. And the International Atomic Energy and the World Bank have announced a new agreement to cooperate on the development and financing of nuclear power for developing countries, including extending the life of existing reactors and speeding up development of small modular nuclear reactors. This memorandum of understanding is part of the bank's return to nuclear energy financing. Grossi said that the landmark agreement was, quote, a sign of the world's return to realism on nuclear power. This from the man who keeps beating the drum about the dangers at the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plants. All to be continued. What's wrong with putting small modular nuclear reactors in the hands of developing nations or even developed nations is part of the subject of this week's interview with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We'll have this week's featured interview in just a moment, but first, as we come up on the 80th anniversaries of the start of the atomic age, the Trinity test in New Mexico, the U.S. bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and all the rest coming up through the U.S. bombardment of Iran, nuclear is in the forefront of the news these days, and that hot button is being pushed in news stories, many of which range from ill-informed and naive to hysterica and maliciously warmongering. Now is not the time to deal in approximations of the nuclear truth. We need hard facts from knowledgeable, genuine experts, and that's what you're going to get from Nuclear Hot Seat. This week we have the first of what will be several interviews to help you understand the science of uranium enrichment and the risks that are being taken in the Middle East. Different perspectives from what you might be getting from mainstream media to help you understand what's happening, why, and even a bit of what can be done about it. That's why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. Every week, we seek to provide verifiable nuclear information and interviews with people who are genuine experts on the nuclear industry and its impact on life, health, and our shared genetic future. We also tell you stories of activists on the front lines around the world, their triumphs and challenges, and what any one of us can do to join these efforts. But Nuclear Hot Seat cannot survive without your support, meaning donations. So if you're grateful for the information you get from the show, the exact right time to donate would be right now. Just go to nuclearhotseat.com and click on the red donate button. If you have Zelle, you can send money directly to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Nuclear Hot Seat is a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that anything you donate is tax deductible. Any amount helps, so don't wait. Go now to nuclearhotseat.com to donate. And know that whatever you can do to help, I am deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now here's this week's featured interview. Dr. Gordon Edwards is a mathematician, physicist, nuclear consultant, and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He is one of our most cogent thinkers on nuclear issues, and he regularly puts together pieces to give us a clear picture of exactly what is going on, whether we should be alarmed, why we should be alarmed, and what we can do about it. He's one of my favorite interviewees because what he presents is always clear, easily understood, and smack dab in the middle of verifiable truth. Here, we discuss uranium enrichment, a hot topic, you should pardon the pun, in the wake of the U.S. bombings of nuclear facilities in Iran. What he reveals exposes how ineffective the bombings really were, far from the total obliteration almost immediately claimed by the U.S. president and now being echo-chambered by his followers. And what's the big deal about nuclear enrichment? Dr. Edwards also includes a vision of how we could work to a lasting international nuclear peace and the elimination of even the possibility of creating any more nuclear weapons. I spoke with Dr. Gordon Edwards on June 30th, 2025. Dr. Gordon Edwards, it's always a pleasure to have you on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Likewise, Libby.
You've been publishing a lot in the last few weeks regarding issues related to Iran and the U.S. bombing of the Iran nuclear enrichment sites and what that actually means. I have to say that uranium enrichment is not a subject that I have a great deal of familiarity with. So I would appreciate your explaining what have been the concerns kicked off by Iran's uranium enrichment program.
People are concerned about the spread of the atomic bomb to nations that we think are a particular threat to us and our allies, Israel being an ally of the United States and of Canada. But the world in general, if we have nuclear weapons spreading to nations around the world, then any conflict anywhere in the world can turn into a nuclear war. And that's a very concerning issue because once a nuclear war starts, nobody knows how to put an end to it. Nobody knows how to call a truce or a ceasefire. The reason for that is that once one nuclear bomb goes off, you don't know how many more are coming. And therefore, there's a panicky reaction. We have to either use them or lose them. In other words, if we don't fire our nuclear weapons right away, they might be all gone in a nuclear holocaust of its own. So how many minutes do you have to decide to make such a decision? It's frightening to think of. And if you think of countries like India and Pakistan, both of which are nuclear armed and which are close neighbors of each other, you don't have any time to think. If one nuclear explosion goes off, you have to retaliate instantly or not at all. So this is a concern. The concern is the spread of nuclear weapons capabilities around the world. I have a lot of concern about my consideration is that you cannot run the world forever on hypocrisy. You cannot run the world forever on a double standard. And the idea that some countries are entitled to have nuclear weapons and other countries are not entitled to have nuclear weapons is, I think, a non-starter. If you really want to have a peaceful world free of nuclear holocaust, then you really have to think about a world without nuclear weapons altogether. And in fact, we have legal instruments, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, for example, where it is stated in Article 6, those countries with nuclear weapons promise to negotiate in good faith to get rid of them. And what we see is the opposite. Right now, we see a world in which the United States, Russia, China, and other nuclear weapon states are ramping up their nuclear capabilities, doing the opposite of getting rid of them. We're simply accelerating the lethality of these weapons. And at the same time, we are pointing to countries like Iran, which they say should never have a nuclear weapon. So what we're saying is, do not do as we do as we say.
Uranium enrichment has been a sticking point, has been a focus for the bombings and for a lot of the discussion that's been going on. Explain what uranium enrichment is and what is important about it as regards weapons.
Okay, the first thing to know is that uranium is the only material found on Earth naturally occurring that can be used to make an atomic bomb or to fuel a nuclear reactor. Without uranium, there would be no nuclear weapons of any description, nor would there be any nuclear fission reactors. But there's only one type of uranium that can be used for those two purposes, and that's called uranium-235. And when you mine uranium out of the Earth, only 7 atoms out of 1,000 are uranium-235. That's the so-called chain reacting type of uranium. It's the uranium that can undergo a nuclear chain reaction to release untold power and destroy cities with a single bomb like we did at Hiroshima in August 6, 1945. That was a uranium bomb. A single uranium bomb destroyed an entire city. When you mine uranium out of the Earth, there's only 7 atoms out of 1,000 that are chain reacting types of uranium. So the question is, natural uranium, with only 7 atoms out of 1,000 that are explosive, you might say, it cannot be made into a bomb. You can't make it. There's too much dead weight. There's too much of the other type of uranium, which is called uranium-238. That's non-chain reacting. It cannot be used to make a bomb, nor can you use it if you've got too much uranium-238 present. That means that you need to concentrate those chain reacting uranium atoms into a much higher percentage in order to make a bomb or in order to fuel a nuclear reactor. Now, for a nuclear reactor, you only have to go up a little bit. You can go up to 3% or 5% of the chain reacting variety. That's a lot more than natural uranium has. And that can be used as fuel for light water nuclear reactors, as all of the power reactors in the States. If you go all the way up to 90%, that's called weapons-grade uranium. And that can be used to make beautiful, powerful atomic bombs that are enormously destructive. I say beautiful only from the point of view of weaponeers. However, it's a mistake to think that you need 90% enrichment to make an atomic bomb. In fact, the Hiroshima bomb used on the city of Hiroshima in 1945, it was a uranium bomb, and it was only enriched to about 80%. Now, Iran has enriched about 400 kilograms of uranium up to the 60% level. 60% is more than enough to make a powerful atomic bomb. So if they wanted to, Iran could make atomic bombs with the uranium that they've already enriched. And I don't believe that any degree of military bombing would have destroyed those stockpiles of enriched uranium. I'm sure that Iran would have moved those stockpiles of uranium to a different location in order to hang on to it for later use. Now, according to the International Atomic Energy Agency, 20%, even at 20%, you have at that point achieved what's called highly enriched uranium. 20% and beyond is considered highly enriched. According to the International Atomic Energy Agency, you can make a bomb out of even 20% enriched uranium, but it would be a very big device, a lot bigger than the bomb that you could drop from an airplane. You could, however, put such a bomb in the hull of a ship, sail it into the harbor and let it rip. Or you could put it in a truck and cross the border and let it rip. Or you could put it even in the trunk of a car and detonate it by remote control. So as was said under the President Reagan's domain as presidency, we could wake up one day and find Washington, D.C. gone and not even know who did it. So these bombs don't have to be delivered by missiles or by airplanes. They can be delivered by any method that one can think of for delivering an explosive device. Most recently, they've been talking about building new reactors in the United States and elsewhere, which have higher degrees of enrichment than previously. Up till now, all of the power reactors in the world use no more than 5% enriched uranium. At that level of enrichment, at that level, remember again that when we say 5%, what we're talking about is the explosive kind of uranium. It's called uranium-235. It's the chain reacting type of uranium. That's the stuff you need to get nuclear energy from it, either in the form of a bomb or in the form of a nuclear reactor. Now, if it's only up to 5%, you can use it as fuel for a reactor, but you can't use it for bombs. It's just not enough. You have to get up to at least 12% before you can even think of it. But there is a kind of a gray area in between 12% and 20%. It's still called low enriched uranium, but that stuff can be used for powerful weapons. You can make powerful bombs out of uranium that is enriched below 20%, but above 12%. Now, this is a danger zone because in that zone, we find a lot of the newly proposed nuclear reactors that are being promoted in the United States and around the world. For example, the Natrium reactor that is being built in Wyoming or is planned to be built in Wyoming will use a not highly enriched uranium, but this intermediate ground is called HALEU. HALEU means high assay, low enriched uranium. It's a fancy word, HALEU. It's a danger zone because you can make bombs with it directly without having to do further enrichment. And that is a real problem because the United States and other countries like Canada want to sell these reactors around the world. They think that this is a sensible way to fight climate change, even though there are alternatives which are much cheaper and much faster to build and much quicker to pay back their investment. Nevertheless, there is such a vested interest in nuclear. So much money has already been poured into this technology that the governments of several countries, including the United States and Canada, have been convinced that their best bet is to invest billions and billions of dollars in nuclear power plants. They are too slow and too expensive to really be an effective way of fighting climate change, but that's what's happening nevertheless.
When you talk about weapons in the 12 to 20% enrichment range, how does that relate, if it does, to what we call dirty bombs?
Dirty bombs are different. Dirty bombs are conventional bombs, just using conventional explosives to scatter dangerous radioactive material abroad. For example, plutonium happens to be very toxic. It's 18,000 times more toxic than tritium. People have heard of tritium. It's radioactive hydrogen. Every disintegration of tritium, that's called a becquerel. One disintegration per second is called a becquerel of tritium. In the case of plutonium-239, one becquerel is 18,000 times more biologically damaging. So if you put a small amount of plutonium, even a few grams, and surround it with conventional explosives and just detonate it in a downtown area or in a shopping mall or in the ventilation system of a large building comparable to the World Trade Center, for example, you can kill an awful lot of people. That's a dirty bomb, but that's not a nuclear explosion. It doesn't have the destructive power. It's just dangerously radioactively contaminating of people's lungs and bodies.
With the enrichment that Iran is doing, is it illegal?
No, it's not illegal. That's the ironic thing here, is that there's no law or treaty which actually prohibits enriching uranium to any desired degree. In fact, the United States and Canada and the United Kingdom and France and many other countries enrich uranium to very high levels, including weapons grade levels, just in order to achieve certain civilian purposes. For example, there are certain civilian nuclear reactors that we had in Canada here that produced medical isotopes, and they used weapons grade uranium as targets for producing those medical isotopes. Now, the danger is that anybody who has their hands on weapons grade uranium can simply make a choice to use it for peaceful purposes or to use it for military purposes. So you're putting an awful lot of trust in the government you're giving this material to, or the government you're entrusting this material to. And there's not a lot of trust for the Iranian government for very good reason, because they are a very totalitarian regime and very fanatical in many ways. Also sworn enemies of Israel and sworn to eradicate Israel from the face of the earth. So in that case, the idea that they would have access to weapons-grade uranium, even though they claim it would be for civilian purposes, and it could well be for civilian purposes, but do you trust them to be able to just turn around and use that for bombs? It doesn't have to be 90%, however. They could make very good weapons with 60% enriched uranium, which they already have. They already have a large stock of 60% enriched uranium. And just because you may blow up the centrifuges that produce that material in the first place doesn't mean the material itself has been destroyed. It's still there.
If Iran does still have its 400 kilograms of 60% enriched uranium and they choose to make a bomb out of it, do they have the means to deliver it, to get it to one of the targets, be it Israel, be it the United States, or someplace else?
I do believe they do. They have, of course, rockets aplenty, and those are what you need to deliver these weapons. Now, a bomb made out of 60% uranium will be a little larger in size than one made out of 90% enriched. The higher the enrichment, the smaller the actual physical size of the bomb could be. But it could be equally powerful, and it's just a question of accommodating a larger payload.
With the bombing that the U.S. did, what do we know about any potential radiation release, any toxicity, either from uranium or from any of the materials that are used to enrich the uranium, such as uranium hexafluoride.
Yes, well, uranium itself is not a material whose radioactivity is going to kill anybody quickly. It doesn't give off any penetrating radiation, such as gamma radiation, so you can't fry somebody with uranium. The danger of uranium is inhalation. When you inhale it or ingest it into your body, then it slowly damages the interior cells, and those cells, some of those cells, may slowly turn into cancer cells. But the cancer would not normally show up for decades after exposure. So it's a poisonous material. Of course, it's a radioactive heavy metal, and you know all heavy metals are poisonous. But it's not necessarily going to kill you right away, but it will contaminate your body in such a way that you may die years or decades later from various forms of cancer. That's the main danger from uranium as a radioactive material. However, in this particular case, in order to enrich it, you have to turn it into a gas. Uranium is not a gas, it's a heavy metal. But you can make a compound with fluorine, and it's called uranium hexafluoride. And it's a very nasty material, very, very toxic to humans. If you breathe that in, it's going to kill you chemically, not by radioactivity, but just because of the chemistry. On contact with moisture, it turns into a very caustic acid, which is going to burn the organs of anybody who inhales it. And so it's dangerous from a chemical point of view rather than from a radioactive point of view.
Do we have any knowledge as to whether it was released in any of the bombings that took place?
I haven't heard a word of any traces of uranium hexafluoride that have been seen, but I imagine that the workers, this would probably be exposure of workers in the facilities themselves who would be so exposed. Now, that would only be if the centrifuges had that gas in them at the moment that the bombs took place. It's possible that Iran had enough time to shut down the centrifuges, extract the uranium hexafluoride, store it into airtight drums, which is what they normally do, and then move those drums to another location so that they would still be there, still be available for use later on. And at any given moment, that hexafluoride can be reconverted by chemical means back into a metal. And it's in the form of a metal that it would be used as a nuclear explosive.
The geopolitics around this have been kicked into overdrive, confusion, conflicting stories, and a great deal of uncertainty. If you were in charge of the geopolitics surrounding enriched uranium, what steps would you take to dial back the current level of risk and danger?
Well, it was already done under the Obama administration. Dialing back the danger was exactly what the original deal with Iran was, and Iran agreed to it. And the deal was very, very strict. It was a deal signed by all the parties involved that would not allow Iran to enrich uranium beyond 5%. That's much lower than what would be required for some of the new reactors that we're building in the United States, for example, or and in Canada. So it's a very strict limitation on the degree of enrichment. Iran agreed to that. Now, Prime Minister Netanyahu goaded the first Trump presidency into breaking out of that deal. And so the US broke that deal and said, we're no longer going to abide by it. So all of a sudden, that agreement was gone. And Iran proceeded to enrich beyond the 5% level, all the way up to, as we know now, up to the 60% level. So it's ironic that Trump is now trying to establish a deal with Iran when he's the one who walked out of the original deal. And that original deal was the tightest agreement ever made in the world to limit uranium enrichment. At the time, I gave some interviews about that deal, and I pointed out that Iran had also agreed to intrusive inspections by the International Atomic Energy Agency, that the International Atomic Energy Agency could send their inspectors to any facility, underground or above ground, anywhere in Iran, and verify that nothing was being done to violate that deal. It was Prime Minister Netanyahu who was so very concerned, with very good reason, for Iran's other activities, support of Hezbollah, support of Hamas, support of the Houthis and Yemen. Because Prime Minister Netanyahu was so concerned about the other military activities of Iran and its proxies, they wanted no deal. They did not want this deal because this deal allowed Iran to keep some of the money that was previously blockaded from their, they were prevented from accessing billions of dollars in funds. These were what are called sanctions. There were strict sanctions against Iran prior to the signing of the deal. The signing of the deal not to proceed with nuclear weapons allowed Iran to have access to those billions of dollars. And I think Prime Minister Netanyahu was more worried about that than he was about the nuclear situation. And so he wanted that deal broken so the sanctions could be reimposed. And so we're going around a kind of a merry-go-round here. But I would like to point out that in my view, that agreement not to enrich beyond 5%, if that were not just a deal with the Iranians, but an international agreement with all parties that none of them would enrich beyond 5%, I think you would have a real basis for peace. Because I don't believe that you can expect that you're going to have long-standing peace when some parties are allowed to enrich up to 93% and other parties are not allowed to enrich beyond 5%. Let's make it a universal rule. If nuclear weapons are bad, and if access to nuclear explosive materials is bad, then let's make it bad for everybody. And let's agree that none of us are going to enrich uranium beyond 5%. That would be the beginning of the end of the nuclear weapons program worldwide, which is all what we really want in the long run.
What do you think are the odds of something like that happening, and who might be, what might be the country that leads it?
Well, you know, the International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985 for pointing out, first of all, that there is no cure for nuclear weapons, that we doctors cannot help you. In the case of a nuclear war, there will be no hospitals, there will be no medication, there will be no medical personnel. We can't help you. So don't think that there's a cure for nuclear war. The only cure is prevention. The other point they made is that nuclear weapons are akin to an addiction. And like all addictions, it's not easily broken. And that the only way that you can break an addiction is to have a good support group of people supporting the addict and strengthening his resolve to rid himself or herself of the addiction. And that's what the other countries of the world should be doing. And that's what the citizens of the world should be doing. They should be putting pressure on the nuclear weapon states to get rid of their nuclear weapons, to stop pursuing endless nuclear proliferation, which can only result in endless nuclear war. Sooner or later, these weapons are going to be used by somebody somewhere. And when they start being used, who is going to blow the whistle on and call it to a stop? So we really have the power for the first time in the history of evolution, 4 billion year evolution of life on Earth. We, the human species, have the ability to put an end to it all in a matter of hours. And we shouldn't really live with that risk. If we want to have non-suicidal children and grandchildren, then we have to make a future which is going to be sustainable and at least offers a hope of peacefulness internationally. And I believe that that's a worthwhile goal. And I think that's the goal we are legally obliged to pursue according to the Non-Proliferation Treaty. But it only makes common sense from a human point of view. And even from the point of view of the 4 billion year evolution of life on Earth, why put an end to that? We're the only planet in the solar system that has this amazing multitude of life. Why would we want to end it?
Can you see anything good coming out of the current situation?
I think that the best thing about it is that it has opened some people's eyes to the dangers of uranium enrichment and therefore to the dangers of nuclear power as a whole. Because it's necessary, if you want to put an end to nuclear weapons, you really have to put an end to the material foundation of nuclear weapons. And that is access to the weapons usable materials, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. If you make those materials inaccessible, not just to the weapon states, but to everybody, including terrorists, including criminals, they can't get a hold of what isn't there. So putting an end to the production of these materials, stopping uranium enrichment, stopping plutonium extraction, which is called reprocessing, these would be material steps in the right direction. And in fact, our Prime Minister Pierre Elliott Trudeau, the father of the recent prime minister who just resigned in Canada, he made a speech to the United Nations in 1978 in which he espoused what he called a strategy of suffocation. He says, if we want to really put an end to the nuclear weapons race, then we have to choke off the vital oxygen on which it feeds. And the vital oxygen on which it feeds is the existence of these weapons-grade materials, highly enriched uranium and plutonium. Stop the production of those, and you don't get rid of nuclear weapons immediately, but you make it possible to get rid of the existing nuclear weapons without fear that somebody else, somewhere else, is building new ones. As long as people are producing the materials, you can never be sure that somebody around the corner isn't producing more nuclear weapons. We want to get away from that. The only way you can get away from that is to get rid of the material foundation on which it's based.
Is there anything else you'd like to add at this point?
I would like to add one thing, and that is that it turns out that enriched uranium bombs are much easier to make than plutonium bombs. Plutonium can also be used to make nuclear weapons, and that's where a lot of the concern has been expressed over the decades, access to plutonium. True, that's a danger. But it turns out that plutonium bombs are much more complicated to build. You need to have a perfect sphere of plutonium surrounded by plastic explosives that drive that sphere inward toward the center. It's called an implosion device. It's not a simple thing to make. It can be made, however, by terrorist groups or criminal organizations or even demented individuals. But with a uranium bomb, the mechanism is so simple that anybody could do it. All you have to do for a uranium bomb is to fire one chunk of uranium into another chunk of uranium called a target in such a way that both of those two pieces add up to more than a critical mass. There's a thing called a critical mass of uranium. You can't have a bomb without a critical mass. So if you fire one chunk of uranium, enriched uranium, into another chunk, you can have a powerful explosion. That's the way the Hiroshima bomb worked. And you don't even need to test a bomb like that. America used that bomb on Hiroshima without ever testing it. It was so simple, it could not fail. And so enriched uranium, if anything, is even more frightening than plutonium as a bomb material. The bombs can be made by anybody who knows how to make bombs of any kind.
What a joyful conversation.
Oh, you asked me for the bright side of this. I think the bright side is that many people may come to the realization that we can't keep going down this path and that uranium enrichment is not the blessing that it is sometimes thought to be. As we enrich the uranium, we impoverish the world.
Dr. Gordon Edwards, you maintain a level of understanding and an ability to express it about this very complex set of issues that is truly remarkable and always welcomed by myself and I know by my listeners from the feedback that I get from them. So for the work that you've been doing and continue to do, long may you wave, and thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much, Libby.
That was Dr. Gordon Edwards, a mathematician, physicist, nuclear consultant, and co-founder and president of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. We will have links up to two recent articles that he's written about uranium enrichment through the lens of the recent U.S. attacks on Iran and the geopolitics around Iran's nuclear program. They'll be on our website, NuclearHotSeat.com, under this episode, number 731.
Activists, shout out.
The International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, or ICAN, has launched an online memorial for children who died in the U.S. atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, this ahead of the 80th anniversary of those attacks. ICAN quoted authorities that an estimated 38,000 children were killed in the bombings on August 6 and August 9, 1945. The new platform, called Children's Peace Memorial, provides profiles of 426 such children, quote, to remind the world of the horrific impacts of nuclear weapons. And it encourages visitors to make paper cranes and send them to countries that have not yet joined the UN Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. On next week's program, number 732, we'll have the ICANN update with their head of media, Alistair Burnett, and he will include an interview with Daniel Hoogstra, ICANN's deputy director, and the person behind this new online Children's Peace Memorial. For those of you who may be in Ohio in the month of September, I am thrilled to report that the Peace Resource Center of Wilmington College in Wilmington, Ohio, as part of their 50th anniversary, is going to be presenting my play, Atomic Bill and the Payment Due. It is an Oppenheimer-adjacent true story of media manipulation at the dawn of the atomic age, and the New York Times reporter who sold his soul to get the story. It both asks and answers the question, how do you hide a nuclear bomb explosion in plain sight? It will be presented on September 9th at 7:30 p.m. in the Highland Theater, which is a beautiful 400-seat professional-level theater on campus. I will be there, and I look forward to as many of you as possible being there as well. And tuck yourself in for milk and cookies time again with another story from our collective activist past by Jack Cohen Joppa of The Nuclear Resistor. Here, he presents his personal story of involvement in protests at the Rocky Flats site in Colorado as this month's inspiring Nuclear Resistor story.
In 1978, as the Cold War was heating up, I was a student at the University of Colorado in Boulder. When I learned of a big protest being planned at the nuclear bomb plant south of town, I signed on. Growing up in Metro Denver, I knew a little about the Rocky Flats plant, its history of plutonium fires and radioactive water pollution. My sister and her young family lived nearby, downwind in Arvada, and I was eager to stand up and say no. A major rally was planned for late April, capped by a symbolic blockade of the railroad spur that served the only factory producing the plutonium pits at the core of every U.S. nuclear weapon. I joined a big weekend training for nonviolent direct action, planning to support those who would risk arrest. The day of the rally, more than 5,000 people listened to Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg and other speakers. Later, Dan and about 100 others climbed over a barbed wire fence, set up some tents on the tracks, and expected to be arrested. But police held back as a late spring blizzard blew away the balmy afternoon. Maybe Mother Nature would do their job. I was on the legal side of the fence, and as the snow swirled and drive time radio and TV reported on the historic rally and ongoing blockade, I witnessed a beautiful thing. One after another, people drove up unsolicited with hot food and drinks, tents and tarps, blankets and boots for the ill-prepared blockaders. Those who could bear the weather huddled between the tracks in a makeshift meeting room fashioned out of abandoned railroad ties and plastic sheets. The next morning, rally organizers returned and told the few dozen who remained to go home. They had promised the union and plant management a symbolic blockade. If police made no arrests, the blockade would end. But the blockaders, schooled during their training in Gandhian nonviolence and the American traditions of civil disobedience, concluded that they could not, in good conscience, leave the tracks. There they were, in the right place, at the right time in history and in the right manner, nonviolent opponents of the local hazard and global threat that was Rocky Flats. So they took a new name for their campaign and, honoring Gandhi, called it Rocky Flats Satyagraha, or the Rocky Flats Truth Force. While they sheltered on the tracks, Dan Ellsberg led teach-ins, sharing his deep knowledge of U.S. nuclear policy based on secret documents he would later write about in his 2017 book, The Doomsday Machine. They camped in the snow for almost a week, a magnet for media and a beacon of hope until sheriff's deputies packed themselves into an empty boxcar, rolled it up to the blockade, and poured out to arrest the activists. Released from jail that very afternoon, they held a press conference and vowed to return. I skipped my last two final exams to see that happen, and joined more than 200 others who were arrested at Rocky Flats through that summer and fall. The Rocky Flats Truth Force was drawing broad local, national, even international support as every train, in or out, was blocked, often leading to arrests and sometimes jail. 10 of us went on trial that fall, representing most of the others in exchange for the judge hearing expert testimony about the impact of plutonium on human health from a trio of world-renowned nuclear experts: the plutonium chemist and molecular biologist Dr. John Goffman, health physics pioneer Dr. Carl Morgan, and trailblazing epidemiologist Dr. Alice Stewart. The judge did not let the jury hear the experts, but the jury did hear our varied and passionate testimonies. After 10 hours of deliberation over 2 days, we were convicted of trespass and acquitted of obstruction. Out in the hallway after the trial, amidst the crush of reporters and supporters, one juror came up to me and confessed, "We all support you and your cause." Over the next decade, there were regular protests, prayer vigils, and even an encirclement of the Rocky Flats plant, and many were jailed for their direct actions. In 1989, Rocky Flats was famously raided by the FBI over continuing environmental crimes and shut down for good. Today, the government is still struggling to replace Rocky Flats with expensive new pit factories in New Mexico and South Carolina. This has been Jack Cohen Joppa for Nuclear Hot Seat, with my own story from the Nuclear Resistor Archives that I hope might inspire your activism today.
That was Jack Cohen Joppa with his monthly story from our shared activist past. Jack, along with Felice Cohen Joppa, runs the Nuclear Resistor newsletter and does so much more. You can sign up for that newsletter and follow their work at nukeresistor.org. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, July 1st, 2025. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, it's the easiest way to not miss a single episode, so you know exactly what's going on in the nuclear world. To sign up, just go to nuclearhotseat.com and you will see a big yellow opt-in box. You really cannot miss it. Put in your first name and an email address, and like magic, every week, you will get one, just one email, with a link to that week's show and a short description of its content. You will get your link as soon as the show posts. Or if you prefer, and you listen to podcasts a lot, go and sign up on your favorite podcast platform. Whatever you do, make certain that you get each week's news, because, man, this story keeps growing and evolving, and there's more of it all the time. And you can help us keep up with the latest stories by letting us know if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview. You can do so by sending an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate to support us, thank you. Any amount helps us out, and we really appreciate whatever you can do. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2025, Libby Halevi and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use allowed, as long as you cite the program, website, names of any guests whose comments you use, and me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you, we can always come up with the date that a nuclear emergency begins, but we can never come up with the date that it's over. Because once it starts, it is never over. There you have it, your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So, whatever you do, don't go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat, what are those people thinking?
Nuclear hot seat,
what have those boys been drinking?
Nuclear hot seat,
the corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat, it's da bomb.